Okay, we're ready. Parshat Vayigash. So we finally have our reconciliation between Yosef and the brothers. If you recall, last year we spoke about, was it really a reconciliation or not, and what the terms were. And the truth is, in order to really appreciate what I'm saying today, you have to remember everything I said last year, which most of you don't, for various reasons. If you weren't here is a good reason. If you were here, there are other reasons. No pressure, by the way. So starting from the first source, Perek Mem Vav, Pasuk Hey, Vayakam Yaakov in Beersheva, it's not that he lived in Beersheva, but rather he made a stop there. The reason he made a stop there was that's the place that you stop before you come down to Egypt. And that's the place that Yitzhak had stopped, and then God said, don't go. And this is where Yaakov stops, and God says, I'll be with you. So obviously, different patriarchs, different instructions. It's not one-size-fit-all patriarch rules. V'yakam Yaakov mi-Beersheva v'yisu b'nei Yisrael et Yaakov aviyam v'et tapam v'et nishayim v'agalot asher shalach paro l'seitoto. So they go and they travel, and it's the young and it's the old and it's the wives and it's the caravans, if you will, that he has sent, or the wagons. V'yikhu et miknehem. Now, one of the things that I do want to know today is what the word miknehem means. So I know this is quite unusual, but I actually looked it up in a dictionary to see what the word miknehem means. And I'll tell you exactly what my doubt is, or my question. Is miknehem a term which is used specifically for cattle, mikne, or does it mean acquisitions, which would be mikne? And is it perhaps that in antiquity, cattle was so wrapped up with acquisitions and possessions that therefore the terms became the same? But in terms of the root of the word, if you wanted to say to acquire, it's a kinyan. You wanted to say something that you've acquired is a mikneh. And on the other hand, we use it to describe flock. So is that a natural definition, or is that an acquired definition, if you will? So v'yichuv miknehim, and the next phrase, I hope fully you remember a phrase like this previously. Ve'et rechushama sherechashu be'eretz Kanan. Right? Does that ring? Because this is the second bookend. Where was the first bookend? When Avram first comes and he leaves. Everything that they acquired where? In Haran. He brings to Eretz Kanan, and that's the beginning of the what we can call the settlement of, or the proto-settlement, the settlement of the patriarchs in the land of Israel. But now you get this sense that this is the other bookmark, and now it's come to an end. Which means we had a good run of it. We had Avram, Yitzchak, part of Yaakov's life, and now it's come to an end. The next generation to a bit, but it's over. They're leaving now. This is exile. And here, instead of God saying, don't go, go, I'll be with you. But this instead of the patriarch rules, now it's going to be the rules of exile, which is going to present a whole other type of challenge, which we're going to talk about. And I do want to say something, just as an introduction. When we look at various commentaries, my natural inclination is to take everybody at face value and not to then try to interpret where they're coming from when they say this, or whatever it is that they may say. But we're going to deal with exile, then perhaps the particular type of exile that particular type of commentary lived in, or survived, or thrived, as the case may be, perhaps it does color a commentary. And the other thing which could be interesting is trying to take sensitivities and sensibilities which are modern, or I don't even want to say modern necessarily, let's even say the last 200-300 years, and then read them back into what's going on over here. So for example, I may well, I don't know yet, see this will get edited out later, I may well call this class Yosef the First Modern Orthodox Jew. I can't call him centrist Orthodox because there's no one to his left, which is what's so important, right? To be centrist, you always need someone on the other side. Otherwise, you can't be. There's somebody that you have to look down upon. I mean, that's always important for all types of Jews. So was Yosef really modern Orthodox? Of course, now I'm taking essentially a 20th century term and going to ascribe it back to somebody who lived long before, many centuries before the 20th century. I mean, the truth is, if you want to give me a hard time, you can say, well, it's okay except for a couple of things. Somebody asked me a question yesterday and asked me about, are there any rabbis that allow the use of microphone on Shabbat? any Orthodox rabbis who allowed it. So I mentioned there was one rabbi who was in Baltimore many years ago. He wrote essays about it. Everybody attacked him. And Rav Moshe was very strong against it. Others were strong against it. And I'll just qualify. It depends on how it's made. And Rabbi Soloveitchik had a response at the time. He said that the person who allowed it only was missing two pieces of information. One was how electricity works, and two was halacha. So aside from that, everything was dead on, aside from that. But if you come back over here calling Yosef the first modern Orthodox Jew, so what are you missing? Well, was he a Jew? Was he modern? Was he Orthodox? So aside from all the words in the sentence, everything would seem to work fine. But of course, what my question really is that it surrounds long Yosef's integration that takes place. So therefore, the question of integration versus isolation, which will be very different if the isolation that you're dealing with will be an 18th century ghetto, or you're dealing with then a modern world at the time, and to what extent people could fit into modern world. So I want to pause with all that, because again, there could be some things which are very instructive over here, but let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. So vayichud et b'gneim ve'etruch l'shama sherachash beretz Kanaan vayivo mitzrayma Yaakov v'kol zaro ito. Everyone, they're all there. They didn't leave anybody behind. I don't know if you know this, but during the 2,000-year exile, there were a couple families that stayed in Israel the entire time. It's very, very interesting. For the most part, we left, but not everybody. Everybody goes lock, stock, and barrel. They moved out the whole place. Skipping a little bit, getting to source 2, that Yehuda shalach lefanav el Yosef lahorot lefanav goshna. V'yavo artza Goshen. So Goshen always seems to be the objective over here. They go to Goshen. Why he sends Yehuda? What's it about? So I know if you read the Midrash, you'll know that the reason he sent him to Goshen was to open up a yeshiva. So that's the kind of interpretation I was saying before, that's very telling. But is it more telling about the time that was said, or is it more telling about really what Yehuda was doing at the time? But there does seem to be an attempt over here, which Yaakov buys into, and that is an attempt of isolation. Now, let's just pause there for a moment. Avraham, at the first part of his career, is not necessarily an isolationist. And I say that because Avraham is somebody whose reputation is one is reaching out. He gets involved. He's involved militarily in conflicts. He's somebody who reaches out to others, and he calls out in the name of God, as it were. It's the people that he impacted in Haran, and he does not seem to be an isolationist. Yitzchak may have been, but not necessarily by choice. Yitzchak gets isolated because he's a stranger within this larger society, which itself is very interesting. The ability for Yitzchak to integrate, or for that matter, the desire to integrate, is something which is apparently severely limited, but we don't know in terms of Yitzchak's basic attitude in terms of integration, because we just don't have that much information to work on. When it comes to Yaakov, there absolutely seems to be, at some point, a limitation. There seems to be an isolationist position. You could tell me, if you wish, that this is a response to the story of Dina. You can say that that's part of the price which is paid for lack of isolation. But Yaakov does seem to be, and there's a brilliant Meshach Chachma back over there by Yichanan Ta'ir, where the Meshach Chachma reads various rabbinic laws and Midrashim into the Avram versus Yaakov attitudes of isolation versus integration. Well, Erev Chatzeret and Erev Tchumim, and they attach the two different ones to Avram and Yaakov, respectively. But going back over here, we see this desire to get to Goshen. Pasuk Lamed Aleph, still in source 2. Vayomi Yosef el Echav. Now, right when Yosef speaks, what's the relationship? Is Yosef speaking as a younger brother? Well, Yosef never speaks as a younger brother. He is a younger brother. He just doesn't speak as a younger brother. Is Yosef speaking as a political leader in Egypt? Is he giving advice, or is he giving an order? Maybe that's really the question. Vayomi Yosef el Echav ve'el Beit Aviv elev agid leParo ve'omra elav. I'm going to go and tell Paro. So the first part we'll see will be information, and then will come the perhaps order, perhaps advice. Va'omra elav achai ubeit avi asher be'eretz Kanaan bo'u elai. I'm going to tell him that my brothers and father have come. It's also quite interesting. He puts brothers before father. Va'anashim ro'etzon ki anshe miknehoyu. And he says, I'm going to tell him that the people are ro'etzon. So ro'etzon, so now we're back to what we need to be sensitive about. When they left, they said they took kol miknehem, and I wasn't sure if miknehem meant acquisitions or if it meant some types of flocks of larger animals. And over here it says, v'anashim ro'ei tzon. Ro'ei tzon, tzon is always smaller animals. Ki anshe miknehayu. So now you see that both are right there. There are people who deal with flocks, but the type of flocks that they deal with are tzon. V'tzonam uvakaram v'kol asher lahem hiviu. And therefore you see they brought the small animals, they brought the large animals, they brought the bakar, and they brought the goats or the sheep, as it were.
But when Paro calls you, he's going to ask you. So this is once again Yosef, who always knows the future.
Yosef always knows what's going to happen. So Yosef says, you're going to get to Paro, and this is what Paro is going to say.
Vamartem, and this is what you answer. So again, is this advice or is this an order?
Vamartem, and you're going to say, Anche mikne hayu avodecha.
So now notice the way that it's framed over here. It's framed that we deal... Now, how do you want to translate that?
Anshe mikne.
Anshe mikne, do you want to translate we're men of acquisitions? We're men who've made acquisitions? Because the word mikne does mean an acquisition. So we are men who've made acquisitions, or are we saying we're people that have flock, or are they? Or is Yosef, who is always quite clever, deliberately using a word which will not be offensive to Paro? So Yosef is a... diplomat. And diplomats hopefully speak diplomatically. And therefore, Yosef over here is being very careful in how this needs to be said. So of course his brothers, will they listen to him? Because how can they ever possibly listen to him? Because it's Yosef, and what does he know? So again, what does he say to say? What does he say that they should say? Again,
V'amartim anshe mikna hayu avadecha, min ureinu v'ad ata, gam anachnu, gam avotein, bavur teshvu be'eretz goshen.
And then he explains, ki to'avat mitzrayim ko'eretzon. So is that part of what he wants them to say, or is that the explanation for what he wants them to do? Okay, so is that clear? Which means Yosef over here is saying, let's be diplomatic, Paro will understand. You say that you're people who work with mikneh, and I'm going to say it again. It means acquisitions, but it also means animals. But the implication of the animals that we're talking about are probably larger animals. And therefore, we take care of large animals in order, and here's the objective, that Paro will acquiesce, and he's going to give you the land of Goshen. And the reason for this is because you do not want to live together with them. So therefore, essentially what Yosef is advising is a policy which will be a policy of isolationism, which in a sense is respecting his father, but is probably at odds with the way that he's lived his whole life himself. So, because Yosef, not by choice, has been quite integrated. Now, this division within Yosef's life versus the life of the brothers is one which has entertained the imagination of many people over the years. Rav Kook gave a very celebrated talk the last year of his life by Shalosh Shudos. He spoke. And he spoke about how we always read the parasha of Yosef and his brothers during the time that of Hanukkah, where the basic problem of Hanukkah was one of the Hellenists, the Jews who had become followers of Greek culture versus the quote-unquote traditional Jews. And he felt that part of the tension which existed later on in the Greek period had its origin all the way back over here by Yosef. Of course, when it comes down to it, Yosef is Yosef Tzadik. What Rav Kook suggested was actually brilliant. Whether it's pshat or not, you can judge for yourselves. He said that the machloket between Yosef and the brothers was that Yosef felt that the way to be a light unto the nations, now you realize right away that he's now deciding that a prophecy in Yeshayahu, which is not necessarily an instruction, you shall be, or it could be a prophecy that you will be. So he turns it into an instruction. And again, with Yosef, it's always self-fulfilling prophecies. So therefore, there's a prophecy in Yeshayo of the Jews being a light unto the nations. So therefore, Yosef said the way to become a light unto the nations is go live among them and to integrate. And while on the other hand, the brothers said, if we integrate, we're going to disappear. We're going to end up assimilating. So then the brothers see that Yaakov loves Yosef the most. So they're afraid that he's going to decide upon Yosef's approach. So they say, this is pikuach nefesh. We're all going to disappear as Jews, so we have to kill him. And then they say, hold it a second. Why kill him? Why don't we just run a test? See how Jews do when they're sent in order to try to integrate, and we'll send Yosef to Egypt. If he survives or thrives, then it means that he was right. If he fails, then it's his own philosophy which has destroyed him. So then Yosef obviously thrives, but then they say, well, what do you want? Yosef at tzaddik. Not everybody can withstand the temptations that Yosef does, and therefore the test was not a valid test. So that's the way that Rav Kook reads it. And I'll ask you again the question I asked you before. Does that tell us more about Yosef and his brothers or more about Rav Kook? Within a culture, is it one of isolation or is there one of integration? And how is Judaism going to survive? And I'm not going to spell out the rest of Rav Kook's life for you, but there you go. You can now do with this anything that you choose. Okay, just stop with the Zionist propaganda, please.
Come to Israel.
Come to Israel. So let's continue. So what did Yosef tell them to say? Do you remember? Okay, so let's read. Source number 3. Vayavo Yosef, vayagei leparo, vayomer, right? Vayomer, aviva achai. You notice he switched it? What I'm going to say, so he played to the crowd. Okay, maybe he's a politician. He played to the crowd. When he talks to Paro, then it's his father first. Respectful. Aviva achai v'tsonam. Notice he used the word tsonam over here. He says their tzon is here. Uvikaram, v'kol asher lahem bo be'eretz kanan, v'hinam be'eretz goshen. So Yosef also, instead of asking for Goshen, just sets it up as a fait accompli. They are already in Goshen, and they're there with their tzon. So you can already predict what's going to happen. Umiktze echav l'kach hamisha nashim v'tzigem l'fnei paro. One year we went into this whole discussion, which 5 he would have taken, and there's lots of discussion on that. V'yomer paro el echav... Mama Asechem. Oh, exactly like Yosef predicted. That's a strange question, being that he actually just told them what they do. Vayomru el paro, or etzon avadecha. So you notice they blew it, right? They were not supposed to say that. What were they supposed to say? Anshei Mikneh. So they can't listen to Yosef. Gam anachnu gam avotenu, which again is not what Yosef told them to say. Vayomur el paro, lagur ba'aretz banu, ki ein mir el tzon, and again they're focusing on the tzon, which is not what Yosef told them to do. Asher lavadecha, ki kaved arav ba'aretz kanan, v'ata yeshvu navadecha ba'aretz goshen, asking, can we stay in Goshen? And then Paro has some strange responses. Vayomur paro Yosef lemur, avich v'achecha bo'elecha. Yeah, like, duh, Your father and brothers came. Okay. Eretz Mitzrayim lefanecha hi b'meitava aretz. The land of Egypt is open for them, the best of the land. Hoshivat avicha v'tachecha. You can settle them in the best place of the land. And then he says, yeshvu b'eretz Goshen. I have a great idea, Paro says. Why don't you put them in Goshen? Okay. So Paro listens to Yosef. The brothers may not. V'im yadata, and this is really intriguing. This is what the whole class today is about, but we'll just have to go on a long detour to understand it. V'im yadata, what does that mean? And if perchance you have any information, if perchance you know, v'im yadata, v'yesh bam anshei chayil, and among them are any, now we need to define what anshei chayil means, but anshei chayil, is anshei chayil a term? Anshei chayil, it's a thing? There's an eshet chayil. Does eshet chayil mean a woman who fights? Who fights? Chayil. What's an Eshet Chayil? Valor. But Chayil. Chayil is... I know how we translate it. V'im yadata v'yesh bam anshei chayil v'samtem sarei mikna al asher li. And if perchance there are among them, if you want to call them men of valor, I'm fine with that. But I'd rather just use the Hebrew phrase anshei chayil. Right now, I'm avoiding any translation. V'samtem sarei mikne, put them as the leaders, the masters, the rulers of the mikne. Now again, now we're stuck with our problem again. And what's the problem? What does the word mikne mean? Does the mikne mean flock? Does the mikne mean acquisitions? Al asher li. So essentially the question now is, does Paro himself have mikne? And if Paro has mikne, what's the mikne that he has? Does Paro have mikne, which is the generic term? Does he have small flocks? Does Paro himself actually have tzon? Does he have big animals? Does he have, or is this just a question of are these going to be the Brinks guys who are going to be guarding Paro's money? Which means, what exactly did Paro just now ask for? But he also asks it in a very cautious way, and we're going to try to come back to that as well. Rashi explains, Anshei Chayil, Bikim be'umanatan l'ruot tzon, al asher li, al tzon sheli. So Rashi takes it right back to meaning tzon. The tzon is the only thing we've really been talking about over here, even though that's not what we wanted to talk about. But Yosef's sensibility then is really spot on, because he really told them to speak about Mikneh, and Paro will speak about Mikneh, but for some reason Paro really can't talk about tzon, because tzon is not spoken about. And all of you, I think, know why it's not spoken about, or if you don't, or so you all think you know. No, I'm kidding. So you all know what may well be the subtext of all of this. So therefore, we don't talk about tzon. It's not proper to talk about tzon in the White House or whatever house that Paro may have had. So therefore, we speak about Mikneh. And Mikneh is generally acquisitions. And Paro said, oh, you can look after my acquisitions. And I'm not saying this is done with a wink. It's not done with a wink. It's just done, I would think, to avoid saying what Rashi said. Now, Rashi may not... See, what Rashi's doing here is saying, yeah, Paro didn't use that word. I can't tell you if Rashi read everything the way that I read it or not, or if I'm reading it the way that Rashi read it, but I absolutely think that there's a distinction between Mikneh and tzon, and tzon is saying the word sheep or goats, while Mikneh is a much broader term and can also not necessarily refer to animals whatsoever. You look at the Rashbam. You look at the Rashbam, and the Rashbam goes in a very different direction, and he says what my father thought would be pshat right away. Anshei chayil ru'uyim ligvura ulesvara kimo eshet chayilat. Okay, which is also interesting. So he says greatness, people who are powerful, people who are worthy of leadership, which, like an eshet chayil. So, and then actually, if you look in the Rashbam, there's another note there. The note, I put in a different font. V'aniyat sa'ir matzati targum sarei mikneh rabbeinu chele. So there was some Tzair who got his hands on the Rashbam's manuscript, and he wrote, I think, around six different comments like this in various places of the Rashbam, where he adds a note in, then he says, oh, I don't like what the Rashbam said, which basically, so write your own book. Like, why are you ruining the Rashbam for us? And essentially what he did is he took it right back to Rashi. So therefore, you know, the Rashbam, I would assume that the Rashbam, when he was a kid, he learned Chumash and Rashi. Actually, I'd assume he learned Chumash with Rashi. And he grows up, he writes his commentary. So when he doesn't like Rashi, he specifically wants to say something else. So here Rashi says, no, it means to take care of the stone. And he's saying, oh, I want to know if there's any soldiers over here, any people of power, and we'll come back to that. Then somebody had to stick a note in order to confuse all of us, because you don't know who the Ani Hatzair is. Ani Hatzair is not the Rashbam. Ani Hatzair is somebody who wrote notes in the Rashbam, who then argues with the Rashbam. So thank you very much. I'll tell you what Rashi says in the beginning. Rashi says we're talking about people who can be shepherds. Now, why do you need Anshei Chayil to be shepherds? That's interesting. Rashi says that Paro has sheep. What is Paro doing with sheep? The Ibn Ezra, and now you'll understand the Ibn Ezra absolutely understands everything that we now understand. He says, Sari Mikneh kisus kipered. Why does he say sus and pered? Horses and mules. Why does he say that? Because he doesn't want to say sheep. Why does he want to say sheep? Because there's a cultural problem in saying sheep. Because sheep is something where there's a sensitivity in terms of Egypt. And by the way, all this information about the sensitivity we'll see emerges most likely much later on. And we're reading back into Bereshit. It's a Shemot issue, which we're reading back into Bereshit. But he's aware of it. So what can Mikneh mean? So he doesn't want to say he didn't look in the same dictionary that I looked this morning, which is actually a dictionary of biblical phrases and terms. And I from what I saw there, I think the word Mikneh means acquisitions, generically. And he wants to say that it means acquisitions of animals, but he can't say that it's small animals because that would be tzon. So, and he doesn't even want to say cows. That's what's interesting. He doesn't want to say cows, so rather he puts it, so what would Paro have in his stable? So the answer would be Paro would have horses in his stable, Egyptian horses. I mean, this would make a lot of sense. And therefore, he says that's what he wants to put. Now, there's also a subtext to this potentially that I think we should be very sensitive to, that the horses and the wagons, we're going to later also find out in Shemot, are part of the Susvircha, or part of the military. are part of the military. And therefore, did Paro just now say to Yosef, okay, I trust you completely. I trust your brothers completely because your brothers are your brothers because you guys are really close. We all realize how funny that is, right? And because I can trust you, I can trust them because they're honorable people. And therefore, so what do you think? I'll put them in charge of the army. I'm putting them in charge of the tanks. I met a guy a whole bunch of years ago. I had, Naomi and I had both traveled Thanksgiving to speak to the American Armed Forces, the Jewish American Armed Forces, who was stationed in Germany. So we met a guy, I think he was a colonel, he'll correct me because his wife is going to listen to this, and he was in charge of the Iron Dome. And he was the one who decided which how many get sent to Saudi Arabia and how many get sent to Israel. And this is right after he converted. So guess who was getting most of those anti-missiles? They were coming. They were coming over here because he was in, he again one guy. It was like one guy, and he was actually in charge. Maybe I shouldn't say this. I'll get him in trouble. But no. But since then, moved to Israel. Whatever, retired. Lives on his. They both live. They're both in the army. Live on the army pension, and putting somebody in charge of the army. I mean, that's unbelievable. I mean, just realize the implications. And again, I am reading into the Ibn Ezra, but realize the implications of this. It's saying that I can completely trust Yosef's brothers, and how about we put them in charge of the horses? And whoever, let me put it this way. Wagons don't work well without horses. The Merkava, right? Sus v'rachvo doesn't work well without the sus. And if you're going to say, let's take Anshei Chayil, maybe some of these guys happen to be brave, strong people that we can put in charge. I don't know. What do you want to call it? You want to call it the Air Force, and I don't want to call it the tanks. You want to put in the Merkava. You want to put them in charge of the tank unit. That's pretty remarkable. And also, would be remarkable what Yosef's answer is going to be, because is Yosef going to say yes to this? And see this becomes interesting, because I know all of you don't care about Pshat, and all you really care about is the psychological issues going over here, and the emotional issues, and the family issues, and do they get along or not, and what is Yosef's attitude going to be towards his brothers getting a major defense contract, right? What's going to be his attitude towards his brothers getting a major position within the Egyptian military? Is this something that Yosef's going to say, yeah, because this is good, because they're going to listen to me? Well, they don't listen to him. They can't even say the words that he says. I mean, what kind of brothers are these? He says, say this, and they have to say something else. But it's interesting, because Paro, of course, doesn't necessarily understand all of the subtext. So now you realize the difference between the Ibn Ezra and the Rashbam and Rashi is huge in terms of what's the job offer on the table over here. Is he essentially asking them to be shepherds, or asking them to be in charge of the tank unit of the army? There's a difference over here between these positions. And the Rashbam and what he wanted to say is much closer to the Ibn Ezra. Are these people brave people, strong people that we can use somehow? Because we know what he's thinking. We know what Paro's thinking. Paro's saying, I have one Yosef, and that one Yosef revolutionized the entire Middle East. What if I can get 12 Yosefs working for me? That's just unbelievable. I mean, what kind of potential is there over here if there's so many Yosefs around over here? And I didn't want to get into racism, so but okay. One more quick question. Cows are not the problem. Cows are not the problem. Right. Right. But this will also depend on which commentaries we look at. Let's proceed. Source number 7, the Chizkuni. Chizkuni says, Anshei Chayil, Pirish Rashi, Bikim Bumenotem, people who know how to work as shepherds. Dugmat Eshet Chayil, Klomar Chochma. So therefore, finally he took it down. What is an Eshet Chayil? Somebody who has wisdom. Chochma is the issue. Ve'ein lo mekamashmo'o she'ein derech nashim letzeit l'chayil o letzava. He goes, any Eshet Chayil does not mean a combative woman. I mean, some people may think it means that, but it doesn't mean a woman who's combative, somebody who's involved in fighting. But no, it means somebody who's wise. V'samtim sarei mikneh al hasusim v'al perot v'al gamal. So now you realize that what we saw earlier in terms of, that was the Ibn Ezra, correct, is in the Chizkuni, and this happens all the time. The Ibn Ezra traveled around, and he probably wrote 3 different commentaries. One when he was in Spain, and one when he came to France, and he was completely enamored of the French scholars, the Balei HaTosfot, and we find his comments in the French scholars, so we don't know exactly what the origin was, whose commentaries at first, but there's a huge correlation between Ibn Ezra, at least in one of his commentaries. Like I said, there's multiple ones. The third commentary is when he got to England, which one of his, he was hired as a tutor, so his student, who he tutored, wrote a third commentary, which he taught for the British, which obviously was not on the same level as the other two. Okay, I'm kidding about that. But no, this third one is on the same level because the student wrote it, and as opposed to him actually have written it himself. This concept of the wisdom is also found in the Targum Yonatan, which will take us through 8 and 9. You'll see it's underlined, ve'et ha-chochmata. The chayil over here is the wisdom which will be used. Source number 10 is finally going to get to what you wanted to get to. There's a Chaim Paltiel, also from among the Balei HaTosfot. Anche Chayil Klomar Amapar LeYosef Im Kidvarcha Shehem Ro'e Mikne Im Atamakir Bam HaGiburim Tasim Otam Mimunim V'Sarim Al Asher Li. If they're really strong and they're brave and so on, then put in charge of what's mine. And over here, it sounds more personal, what's mine. Ki To'avat Mitzrayim Kol Ro'e Yitzon. That tzon, and this is specifically tzon, the small animals, this is why it's connected to the Korban Pesach. The tzon is something which is detestable to the Egyptians, l'fishem yir atam, because it's something which they worship. L'chein tzorich shiyu giborim l'shmor hatzon. Therefore, we need people who are very strong to protect the tzon. Therefore, you need shepherds who are brave and strong and so on. L'fisha yochlu min atovim she'vim she'ilchamu imam ha-mitzrim l'fishahim yiratam l'chein tzorech she'ir giborim. Now, there's also something really interesting in what he just now said, that you have, we'll call them the Jews, the Jacob family, the Israelites, if you will. These are people who are shepherds. And why are they shepherds? Why don't they respect the Egyptian sensibility? Because they're not Egyptians. Then we have Yosef, who's always by himself on the side. We have the Egyptians, who now we're being told, and again, we'll learn this later on, that they actually worship some of these things. And then we're told about Paro. So what in the world is Paro doing, meaning, where does Paro stand within this whole continuum? Paro should be the ultimate Egyptian, right? He should be the person. So there's something strange about this, but at least what he's doing is he's trying to understand why is it that we need people that are powerful in order to protect the tzon. 11, 12, we have the same kind of approaches. 11 is also one of the Balei HaTosfot, and that's enough. We won't go through all of this. There are nuances in there where they go back and forth, especially in 11, but we're not going to read it, and we'll skip to 13. 13 is the Shadal. So the Shadal is modern. I mean, you could live 200 years ago and be modern, but the Shadal is modern. He's a cousin of the Ramchal. This is Lutzato. And he's modern enough that he's going to quote people that you won't know who they are. Well, you'll see this in a second. V'samtem sar mikna ala sher li. Amar, the Ibn Ezra said, ala susim v'al pradim, that we're talking about the horses and the mules. V'yalpima shevi lamata b'shem Yost. Ah, so who's Yost? I don't know how to pronounce his name, but it's Isaac Marcus Jost, J-O-S-T. He was a historian who wrote about biblical times, today I don't know which department they would have put him in, the Bible department or history department, but he saw himself as a historian, but he wrote about biblical things as well. 1793 to 1860 is when he lived. He himself was not Orthodox, not Reform, and not a shulgoer of any shul. He may have been a nice man. He actually spent most of his life working in an orphanage where he raised orphans. He and his wife didn't have any children. His wife passed away, and he ran the orphanage as he wrote his history books. And he had a theory, so let's take a look, because the Shadal is going to quote his theory. And his theory is most likely taken from other history books, which is really not for today, but he quotes B'Shem Yost, Ki Hamelech Hazeh Lo Haya Mitzri. Elamin Hamalachim Haroim Shabo Mi Eretz Isaiah. Now, I could not figure out what Isaiah is. Somebody will tell me. I'm sure I'll get an email. Someone will tell me. Asia? Could be. Yeah, could be. Asia. I actually Googled it, the way it's spelt like this, and I got Isaiah Thomas. Was every other thing I found in Google was this Shadal. So maybe Asia. Okay, good. That this king was not Egyptian. That's a really good point, because now you understand why, if the king's not an Egyptian, why he may very... Ukavshu et Mitzrayim, and he captured Egypt. And therefore, it's quite likely that this king had a whole bunch of things which was not within the sensibilities of the average Egyptian. See, this also makes the Yosef-Paro relationship a lot more interesting. Because if Paro is an outsider, he doesn't necessarily trust the Egyptians themselves. And Yosef's an outsider, perfect. You're the guy that I need, because you're the guy I can trust, because you're not built into the system. You're not going to be subject to all of the pressure of all the people you grew up with and the people from the hometown and anybody else over here. You're a loner. And that may have been the reason he liked him, which makes it very interesting. But it also could be a reason why Yosef's brothers now are somewhat attractive, because they're also outsiders, and it's the outsiders that he trusts much more. So as I just said, that comment is really interesting. The only question is how far we get into this. So let's just see where else I wanted to go, because we're going to pause a little bit with this Shaddal. Because so far, what do we have? Let's just like regroup and see where we are and where we need to get to still. Yosef's been living alone for many, many years. It's only Yosef. The way that I set everything up today was the question of isolation versus integration. Does Yosef himself ever really integrate? Okay, no. Does Yosef ever really integrate is the question, which means, are those really the choices, isolation versus integration, or are those not necessarily the choices? Which means it's so easy for us to be guilty of the same thing that I accused others of earlier, and that is reading in our own world into the situation over here. Let's just take a bad example right now. Pigmentation of skin. Was the average Egyptian a certain type of pigmentation? Was Paro different? Was Yosef different? Is Yosef easily identifiable, but anybody looks at him and say, oh, he's not one of ours? Just based on what which means those of us who were brought up in America, just for example, America's a melting pot. America's a melting pot of all kinds of cultures, and therefore you end up with all kinds of pigmentations. It's not one particular race which lives over there. Is Egypt something which is dominant in terms of one particular race, and therefore is it obvious that Yosef is an outsider? Is it obvious, for that matter, that Paro is an outsider? Does everybody look at Yosef and say, of course he's not one of us? I just want to pause for a second. There was a really interesting back and forth, which I always interpret in a different way, but I want to read it another way now. And I don't remember who said this. I looked quickly by a red light on the way, but I couldn't find it. But because it may not be on the Mikra Gedola page. But the comment was like this. When Yosef's brothers first get there, it says that he recognizes, they don't recognize him. Vayaker Yosef et achav, and back in Perek Membet, vehim lo kiru, vayiskor Yosef et chamot asher chalam nolem, vayomer leim aragdam atem. He goes, you're spies. So I've said a number of times the reason I think that Yosef accused them of being spies, because he would love, his fantasy is, right? We all have fantasies. Yosef's fantasy, his brothers are actually looking for him. His brothers care. But what instead do the brothers say when they refer to Yosef? They said, "Oh, they're 12 sons. What's? I mean, he's been waiting for 22 years to get to this point. Because again, one second. Slow down. I'm a professional. Yosef has been waiting for 22 years, and he does not know what his brothers think about him. He does not know if they think it's the smartest thing they've ever done, or he doesn't think it's the most, or they think perhaps the most tragic thing that's ever happened." So are they looking for him, or they don't care about him? And what do they actually say when they get to this point? They said, Ve'achad einenu. Einenu. That's like, einenu? That's all. Yosef's listening, einenu? That's it? Yeah, no, like, who cares? So Yosef heard the einenu. Now the question is, will he take revenge on the einenu? He may well take revenge on that einenu. So let's hold on for that a second. But Yosef, so I would have loved to believe that Yosef is saying you're spies because he wants them to say, yeah, we're looking for something. We're looking for our brother. And then I think that would be quite honorable. If they would come in, if they would have said at that point, yes, we are looking for something. You're right. We're looking for our brother. Years ago, we had a brother. Whatever happened, he ended up coming to Egypt. We want to bring our... Yeah, we came for food, but you know what? That's not really why we're here. Yes, we need food, but we want to bring our brother home. Do you think the whole story would have ended right then? I do. I think Yosef would have said right then, and Yosef, here I am. Let's go home. Let's party. Right? So they don't say that. But there's another possibility. That's what I want to get to right now. So I once saw a commentary. Again, I can't find it right now for you. When any of you are on the email list, Belina, when I send out the audio before Shabbos, I will find this and I'll send you the source. the I saw a commentator that said Yosef right away says you're spies. Why does he say that he's spies? Because the best offense, or he's a good defense, but his defense a good offense? I don't know. It depends what sport you're playing. But I know. But notice the women are all correcting. Ain't shit chayil, mi emtza, right? So Yosef is afraid that they're gonna start asking people, who is this Yosef guy? Who is this Tzofnat Paneach? And they was Tzofnat Paneach Hunar Ivri. Everybody knows who he is. He's this Nar Ivri who was kidnapped and he was brought over here and he was in Potiphar's house. Everybody knows the Yosef story. So therefore, what does Yosef say? He goes, you're spies. What does he do by saying they're spies? Now they can't ask any questions about him. Yosef's accusing them of being spies is in order to prevent them from doing any investigation, asking it. Because as soon as they ask, that's it, you're arrested, you're asking questions about Yosef. So Yosef did that because he is different to defend his thing. Now, you like that? It's clever. It's very clever. Now, if Paro is, I'm just going to go back to our Jost. If Paro is also an outsider, and then perhaps leaders of the regime are outsiders, so then it's not all that strange that the Egyptian leadership is outsiders. Yosef is also somebody who is strange and not the same. But again, what I'm getting at is, you know, what are the chances of integration into Egyptian society if there are racial issues? And again, it's not the same sensibilities that people have today, that you can sort of just move from one place to the other and fit in, or at least have dreams of fitting in. And there are cultures that have xenophobia, and there are cultures that are melting pots. And because most of us came from a culture that has melting pots, at least in many senses, we believe that, you know, anti-Semitism or such is not really around, although the reality, of course, we know it's the only thing which truly unites the extreme left and the extreme right. But that's, I'll stop, because we have important things to actually try to learn. So just as a background of all this, and I'm saying this really as a subtext to everything that we've seen so far, is isolation chosen because integration's impossible? How has Yosef's integration been going so far? Has this been something which is really comfortable? Is this something which is easy? Or is this something which is painful? So again, if you track back in Yosef's career till this point, source 14 is a little bit earlier. It's Perek Mem Gimel. When the brothers come back the second time, they return the money and so on. And then Yosef brings them to eat. They're going to be eating bread. Now, as we continue in all this, I'm going to skip all of the everything else which is interesting in the middle. Pasuk Lamed Aleph, V'yurchatz panav v'yetzev v'tapek v'yomer simu lachem, put bread down. Now, is Yosef here giving a hint? Because the Egyptians don't eat bread with Jews. V'yusimu lo levado v'lahem levadam. They had by themselves, and he had by themselves. V'mitzrim ochlam ito levadam, ki lo yuchluna mitzrim l'cholot evrim lachem ki tova hi l'mitzrayim. So what exactly is the toiva? There's something which is completely detestable. So do you realize right now that Yosef, he's not sitting with his brothers, because these are basically, there's a class difference. Yosef is a leader, and these people are in a much lower level, so he can't sit with them. But Yosef also can't sit with the Egyptians, because the Egyptians won't eat with Ivrim. So when it says they won't eat with Ivrim, who is it referring to? Is it referring to the brothers, or referring to Yosef? And it sounds like it's referring to Yosef. Over here, the Targum Onkelos goes out of his way, and this is unusual for him, to actually give a commentary, not just a translation. In 15, he says, they won't imri lachma, arei be'ira de mitzroi dachlin. Why? Because the sheep is something that they worship. And it goes like this, because the Jews are shepherds, therefore they won't break bread with them. Meaning the bread isn't the issue, it's that you can't break bread with Jews, because Jews are people who are shepherds of Tzon, and therefore they can't eat with them. In source 17, which is the Targum Yonatan in Hebrew, ki lo ksherim Mitzrayim, it was also there in the Aramaic, kashrin, lo ksherim Mitzrayim l'cholim yudim lechem ki abakar shel Mitzrayim, shehem yireim lo yudim ochlim, and over here, what word was there in the Aramaic? Be'ira. Be'ira is, I'm not convinced Be'ira is Bakar. Is Be'ira Bakar? Okay, no one knows. Okay, someone must know. Rashi, he really quotes Onkelos. He says Onkelos natan tamlo devar, because he's noting that's Onkelos who's not in the normal sense. This, of course, refers back to source 19. 19 is in Shmot. That's when Moshe makes the plea, let us serve God outside of Egypt, because we're going to do something which is not considered to be culturally acceptable within Egypt, and that is to worship, well, we'll say the Korban Pesach, which is tzon, and if we do this in front of their eyes, they will kill us. And that's followed by the Targum in 19, second part of 19, and Rashi in source number 20. They all go in the same direction. The Radak in source 22, which goes back on our source where they can't eat together, V'lehem levadam le'mitzrayim levadam, Amar hatam ki lo yichlun ki avrim hayu ochlim basar, right? Because the Jews would eat meat, and they were vegetarians. V'mitzrayim lo yu ochlim. And over here, the Radak understands it to be all meat, not just sheep or lamb. Umashu midgadlin hatzon, but he has a problem. Why would Paro have tzon? He says, lechalav ulagiza, that they would either use it for milk or for the wool or something to that effect, but not for the food. So the Radak understands this as to be completely that they are vegetarian along the same lines. The Bechor Shurim 23 separates them because of the class distinction. 24. Vayasimu lo levado shelo yargishu echav shehu ivri ki lo yuchlonu mitzrim lefich lo ochal hu im echav velo hu velo echav im mitzrim. The Egyptians would not eat with Yosef, which is pointing towards this isolated existence that Yosef has, because nobody will even eat with him because he's an Ivri. He remains different. Source 25, the Emek Davar, the Netziv, he puts a little bit more excitement in this. He says the reason that he would eat separately is because he's afraid that one of his servants will pull a knife on him. So he doesn't want to eat with anybody where they have weapons in their hands, which also points towards some isolation. Sherei naguba bechavod v'morah melech ve'im yitavu l'chol imo chas v'shalom elakach derech melech shalei l'chol im avadav mishnei ta'amim shalo yitgane be'ineihem. They shouldn't see. It's like the Queen of England definitely eats chicken with her hands, but nobody can see this. No? V'shalo yitzrichim lasum sakin b'lo'em. Again, just afraid. They can't have weapons on them, because if they have weapons, then his life is in danger, which also then tells you something which I think is interesting. Source 26, the Meshech Chachma tells us, he adds something in which makes it even more tragic. And he's around the same time, more or less, a little bit later than the Netziv, but he writes, HaKavanah heim b'nei beito v'ishto uvanav asher yumitzrim. His children and wife won't eat with him, because they're Egyptians, and therefore they won't eat food with him, and Yosef can't even have dinner with his family. No, you get to this point of isolation. I'm saying this is absolutely fascinating that the Meshech Chachma is willing to go that far. Yosef's by himself. Who are these Mitzrim? Well, the Mitzrim is his family. He invited them to his family. Oh, you thought they were the servants? No. Who are the Mitzrim over here? Ephraim and Menashe. This may have real implications for next week, but this is Ephraim and Menashe and his wife. These are Egyptians. I know you all know that Asnat's mother is really Dina, and therefore she's really Jewish, and so on. The Meshech Chachma doesn't seem to know that. Or at least the boarding school that she went to was one that taught proper culture, and in the proper cultures, you don't eat with Jews. Yes, that's interesting. This whole issue of the eating may go back also to the episode with Potiphar's wife in 27. And there we have that Potiphar puts everything in Yosef's hands except for what? Except for the lechem ashu ho'ochel. So, which at the point that we read that, we weren't exactly sure what the problem was. But now working backwards, learning about the sensitivity as we moved forward, we realized that that actually may be far more involved within our problem. Rashi writes, Aki'im ha'lechem hi ishto. Because the second time that is referred to. The Ibn Ezra in source 30, he quotes, Yesh omer shehu kinoi l'shchivat ishto v'zerachok. V'od ki Adonai Yosef saris haya. That's very funny, the Ibn Ezra accepts one midrash, rejects another one. But rather he says, Bavoyato ivri. The problem is, of course, he's Jewish. Ki hinei mufurash ki lo yichol mitzrim l'chol et ivrim lechem. They won't eat bread with Jews, and therefore Yosef can't even touch. It's taboo. Yosef can't touch his bread even, because Yosef is different, because Yosef is a Hebrew, Yosef is an Ivri, Yosef comes from a different place. Yosef can never possibly integrate. He can have the best job, he can be in charge of the money, he can be the accountant. He just can't come to the country club. Okay? So, again, I personally think that that is a very interesting comment. And the truth is that I think it actually rings true. It's verse 32. The Rosh says he couldn't eat because he kept saying brachot. So you can do with that as you wish. He said brachot. And people have said, why keep saying brachot? Okay, so 33, just in passing, the Al-Sheikh said the whole problem with his wife, the Lechem, and so on. He goes, the truth is he trusted Yosef. He trusted Yosef with his bread, he trusted with everything. He goes, you know who he didn't trust? He didn't trust his wife. That was the problem. and that also is something that we have to file away and think about for another year. Okay. Moving to source 34, but we need to look exactly where 34 is commenting on. This is Perek Mem Aleph. So this goes back to source 28. So let's look at 28 for a moment. 28 is where Yosef gets the job. And he looks at Yosef and he says that Yosef, in Pasuk Lamed Chet, he says, V'yom parlov hanimtzak hazeh isha sheruach elokim bo, which the Targum, we're going to go back and forth, Targum in 34 writes, deruach nivu'ah. He sees Yosef as being a prophet. He goes, Yosef is prophecy. That's the Ruach Elokim, is he has prophecy. Continuing in 28, it says that he places Yosef in charge. V'yomer paro el Yosef, ani paro, Uvil adecha lo yarim ish et yadov et raglo b'kol eretz Mitzrayim. And without you, no one will lift a hand or their foot in all of Egypt. Now, the only question what that means, so look now again in 34 at the Targum on that Pasuk. Lo yarim gvar yat yadei l'mechad zayin, in order to take weapons. V'yat raglei l'mirkav al susya b'kol arad Mitzrayim. That Yosef was put, he was in charge of he was the Sar HaPnim. He was not just in charge of food, he was also in charge of the gun licenses. He was also in charge of the horses. He was in charge of the army as well. Which means right over, now we realize what we're up to by the very end. Yosef is in charge of the army, and where did Paro get to? Paro now sees a whole bunch of these people and says, hold it, maybe we can utilize them. We'll skip the Emek Dover in 35. The only thing really interesting about that is that he quotes his son Chaim. Chaim is Chaim Berlin, the Netziv quoting his son. So source 35, he does that. Basically says the reason Yosef ate bread is because the only thing that was kosher. He goes into a kosher argument there. You can look at that if you wish. And source 34. Source 36 and 37 are going to take us back to where we started today. And that is Perek Mem Zayin, when, you know, the best of the land is in front of you, and the conversation with Paro, and you have brothers who are strong. And the Netziv says in 36, Mitzidi lo yivatzer lo shivotam lo teit lehem akomot tovim migoshen. V'lo kamo shechashav Yosef, shor yiyu mito avim b'nei Paro, b'shfil shor yu ro'o itzon. Ach levakashtam yishvu b'eretz goshen. Ritzonam hu kvodam v'tovam. V'im yadatem harei shelo yu mito avim b'nei Paro. That Yosef was afraid that his brothers would be detestable. These are the greeners. These are the guys who just came over. These are the new immigrants. Paro is going to look at these people and say, you know, what kind of people are these? And, you know, be isolated. But the way he's reading it, the Netziv, again, the Netziv dies 1893. The Netziv says that they're going to come over and Paro is going to look at them and he's going to find them detestable. They're much better off living by them. And Paro is saying, according to the Netziv, as far as I'm concerned, let's integrate them completely or let them work for me completely. Again, the integration is going to be a question mark. But Yosef was embarrassed of his brothers. In source 37, Rav Hirsch, I think, is even a little more sensitive. And again, on that same place, v'im yadata v'yesh bam, if you know any of them are powerful people, ba'adinut yetera hu mivatezot u'kishnei tana'im. Paro is very sensitive to Yosef's feelings. It's fascinating because he's reading into this that Paro knows, he knows Yosef. He's not Yosef, and Yosef is not acting like he normally acts. And he sees that there's a sensitivity over here, that Paro is more, has more emotional intelligence than we ever give Paro credit for, because we think, you know, he's too busy. He's playing golf. He's doing, I don't know what he's doing, but he has no time. You know, Yosef runs the country. And over here, according to Rav Hirsch, be'adinut yitera, he's being very, very gentle and very careful. Could it be that there are really skilled people you don't know? Or Paro is saying, you don't want to know. And perhaps you don't want your brothers to come working for me. So essentially the way he's reading Yosef is as follows. Yosef. First of all, Yosef is the most important person in the entire kingdom. It's tantalizing to have 11 more Yosefs, but he's not going to take the chance of 11 more being as good as Yosef if it's going to mean he's going to lose the one Yosef. He's not going to do anything to lose Yosef. So he's careful and he says, perhaps, maybe, it could be that one of these brothers or some of them, maybe they have capabilities. And he's giving Yosef the ability to say, no, they're not capable. Or no, you don't want to hire them because maybe Yosef doesn't want it. Yosef has whatever he's thinking, but he doesn't want to lose Yosef. And we now just have to go back to Yosef and to just think through Yosef for one more point. One possibility over here is that Yosef is taking revenge on his brothers. Ve'einenu. That's Yosef in their narrative. He isn't. So what's Yosef going to, how he's going to pay them back? Ve'einenu. You guys are not getting jobs. You're not going to be in charge. You're not going to be in charge of the army. Are you kidding me? Ve'einenu. It's payback time. So any of you who like that, so that's one possibility. And it really works all the way through the whole response of Yosef and orientation towards the brothers. He basically takes care of them. And that's why I said we spoke about this a lot last year. But Yosef is therefore saying you don't do anything. There's another possibility. The other possibility is all those commentaries that you saw, which I think surprised you along the way, and that is how much pain Yosef has endured over the years as being somebody who's not an isolationist, but he can't integrate either. He can't integrate because he's not one of them, and he'll never be one of them, and they'll never be one of them. And therefore, Yosef over here can easily say to his brothers, sure, take all these jobs, but again, you're not going to the country clubs, you're not eating dinner with them, you're not doing anything with them, you're just somebody who's going to have a lot of frustration in your life, and maybe what Yosef's doing is protecting his brothers from this and saying, you'd be a lot better off living on your own in Goshen. You don't want to go down this road. I went down this road. You can learn from my mistakes, you can learn from my pain, you don't need to go there. So now how do we read Yosef? As I said, I'm giving you two choices, two paths. Is this Yosef taking revenge because he doesn't want his brothers to have good jobs, self-respect, be able to now hold their heads high because now they're in charge of all kinds of things, even perhaps the Egyptian army? Or is this Yosef who knows what it's like to live the life that he has where even his own family won't eat with him and nobody will treat him as an equal? I mean, people will bow to him. Those dreams come true. But you realize the great irony in Yosef's life. People will bow to him. They just won't eat with him.